This is Taiwan Bound, the English language podcast of Tel Aviv University. Please welcome your host, Ido Aharoni, Tel Aviv University's graduate, member of the Board of Governors, lecturer, writer, and veteran diplomat.
Welcome to yet another episode of Tau Unbound. I'm Ido Aharoni, your host, and it is my pleasure to host today in our studio the lovely Professor Nurit Schnabel. Am I pronouncing your name correctly?
Yes.
Welcome to our studio.
Thank you for inviting me. It's an honor for me to be here.
Let me just say to our viewers and listeners, Professor Schnabel is a professor of psychology. She's part of the School of Psychological Sciences. And her scientific specialty is in the field of relationship, more specifically, improving social relations. We'll talk all about that. What is social relations? How do you improve them? What are the problems that exist in this area? But before we do that, tell us a little bit about your background. So you told me that, first of all, you come from a European family, but also on the other side, a family that has been in Jerusalem for many, many years.
Yes.
Many generations.
Yes, that's true. And also from my husband's part, they immigrated from Calcutta and Karachi, which is now India and Pakistan. At the time, it was all part of India. So we are really mixed.
Cosmopolitan background, family. So tell us about your upbringing. How did you end up in psychology? What was your main fascination with the field that you're studying today?
I think that I was fortunate to grow up, to be an adolescent in a time that was relatively, I think, optimistic. Or as some put it, I grew up in a time that was after World War. And now, I'm not sure, I hope I'm wrong, but we get a little bit of the atmosphere of before a World War. But of course, I hope I'm wrong, but during the time that I was in adolescence, we saw the Berlin Wall falling. We saw there was the Gulf War. I was in the last year of high school when there was the Gulf War. And if you remember, it was even Syria joined the coalition. There was a feeling,
right,
that there is room for optimism, that the world is going to unity. And a couple of years later, there was the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa, the fall of the apartheid regime. So I think that this was fascinating and attracted me to understand these processes of improvement. But now I'm afraid that it's more like a pendulum than progress towards improvement, maybe.
So the sense that that there's that we're approaching the end of history, so to speak,
yes,
because there were so many reconciliations.
Yes.
Is what triggered your interest in the whole concept of reconciliation from a psychological perspective?
Yes. And I remember that there were like three conflicts that were especially interesting for people in the Western countries. So it was us, Northern Ireland, and South Africa. And in the 90s, again, when I was young, there was a feeling that we were going towards a solution.
Right. And in many ways, I think we did see tremendous progress in the resolution of conflicts, during the 20th century, including right here in our region. And so tell us about your early academic work.
So actually, when I started working on reconciliation, I focused on the interpersonal reconciliation, and I tried to understand. So reconciliation has several aspects, but one part in which my research focuses is the need of the conflicting parties to enjoy a positive social identity, what we call social identity. So, by the way, if I use jargon, let me know, because I'm very much
so. So, what is a social identity? If you can describe,
social identity is the way you are perceived by other people or other people that are meaningful to you. And what I suggested in my dissertation is that there are two fundamental content dimensions along which what we call social targets are perceived and judged. And one is their morality, and the other is their agency. And we argued in our work that following conflicts, victims experience a threat to their agentic dimension of social identity. So they feel that they're not respected by others, that their competence is not appreciated and so forth. And the perpetrators experience threat to their moral identity, and they want to restore their positive identity. And we also showed using empirical studies that if they restore their positive identity, then they are more willing to reconcile with each other.
So the process of reconciliation basically involves the ability to understand the other person's predicament in front of you, right? So it's a very basic ancient insight or wisdom, piece of wisdom, to put yourself in the other person's shoes. So that's what you're basically saying, that this was a basic discovery of your early research.
Right, but it's hard. Right.
It's hard to do. Hard to do.
Very hard.
Very hard to do. And so the question is, so what else needs to happen? So, okay, so I develop empathy to the other side, understanding, I collect information about them, try to understand their predicament. What else needs to happen in order for reconciliation to take place?
So I think... So again, there is what we studied and there is what we need in real world. So what we studied is the use of the apology-forgiveness cycle. So what we showed is that when the perpetrator apologizes to the victim and when the victim expresses forgiveness to the perpetrator, then their social identity is restored. So the perpetrators don't feel that they are excluded, that they are viewed as evil and so forth, and the victims don't feel that they are disrespected, and this increases their readiness for reconciliation.
Now, if I'm not mistaken, that part was based on a very personal experience you had.
No, we actually developed it before that, but you mean that I was...
Someone was trying to steal your car when you were in the car.
Yes. I took them. I took.
Tell us about that. That's a fascinating case study, and the ability that you were able to do that, which is, admirable.
Yeah. So this was a It happened, I think, almost 18 years ago, because I remember that I was pregnant and my son is joining the army in August. So it's more than 18 years ago. Somebody asked for a ride in my car. I took him, and then he tried to rob my car, and someone else heard that I'm screaming, and
he ran away with the keys.
Yes, he ran away with the keys.
You couldn't do anything because you
right.
You
how do you know all these details?
Well, I did my research.
But eventually was caught by the police. And and because he was a minor, he was 17 at the time. So a social worker called me and she asked me if I want to participate in a restorative justice procedure. And in restorative justice procedures, the idea is not just to put the offender to criminal to a regular criminal justice procedure, but also to have a meeting between the offender and the victim. And discuss what happens. So when this happens, there is one thing that I didn't say before, that the apology forgiveness cycle can dramatically transform the relations between victims and perpetrators. But this only happens as long as the two parties come with good faith, right?
Right. And I must say, based on my research, that you were quite suspicious because his parents didn't come to pick him up the night he was arrested.
Oh, wow. Yeah. So
you were kind of, you're not sure if they were coming with in good faith.
Yes. I thought because the night of the event, his parents didn't come to pick him up from the police station. And I thought maybe they are used, that was my hypothesis. Maybe they are just used to get phone calls every now and then from the police. And when I met them, I realized that the father was almost blind, so he couldn't drive to the police station. So this was...
Which is a very important point that you made, that we need to study the predicament of the other side. Now, you had no idea that he was legally blind, but now when you met him, you realized that he couldn't possibly drive that night to pick him up.
And he was very sorry. I think the family was very sorry, and also I think that the offender, the minor, I felt that he is sorry for what he did, not just because he was caught, but also because I think that he had regret on what he did. So eventually, I saw this as a successful process because he had to give a talk in the, this is something I don't know how to translate, in the Matnas, like in the community center,
yes,
about this incident and with the purpose of educating other minors in his environment. So I think it is better than putting him in jail, because in jail sometimes minors might, they might learn from older.
Exactly, the opposite friends. Happens sometimes in jail. Yes. People become more proficient being criminals rather than the opposite. And he also had to donate some money to charity.
Yes, yes. They asked me what I want to do. So I didn't want, because I didn't feel that the money is something that will help me personally. So I asked him to donate, to charity as an educational measure.
And so,
but I want to say something that is very important for me to say, because sometimes I think people think that we are naive in promoting restorative justice procedures and so forth. So I want to say that the apology forgiveness cycle in general, or restorative justice procedures more specifically, I think that there is a risk of exploitation. And that's what makes social psychology so, and the insights gained through my research and others' research, so difficult to implement, because it depends on the specific person. So in this particular person, I think that the offender had genuine regret on what he did. But there could be a potential in which people apologize just for instrumental reasons, and not because they are really sorry, and not because they really want to behave better in the future. So this is something that is important to remember.
Now, I'd like to ask about the role of the legal system in this, because what you're describing is a methodology that apparently is working, right? You proved empirically that it's working, and also not that it's statistically valid, but you also represent a personal case where it worked for you.
Right.
And the perpetrator.
But it is important to me to stress that it's not something that always works. So we have to be very careful about when to implement it and when.
So let's put it this way. Given the right circumstances,
exactly,
it could work.
Exactly. And the same with forgiveness. Sometimes people express forgiveness, but then they keep reproaching the transgressor, and they're not really letting go. So that's why I think advocating for using the apology forgiveness cycle is tricky, because it depends on the circumstances and the conditions.
Right. And where is the legal system on all this?
In Israel, you mean? Or
in Israel, elsewhere?
I think there is effort to implement restorative justice procedures. But it's still, I think, in the fringe. It's not in the mainstream.
Is it more on the mediation side of the law or the court side?
I think that it is more today. It is more on the mediation side. It's not a part of the criminal justice system. But there are people who advocate for making it more in the mainstream, but again, with a not in a naive way, but in some circumstances, I think that it can be much more effective than the regular system for both the victims and the transgressors. I will explain why, because for the victims, it is important to have their voice, and also sometimes they don't want the offender to be punished. So, for example, a couple of weeks ago, we had a lecture by someone who promotes the use of restorative justice procedures in cases of sexual abuse within, I think in general, but mainly within families. The victim many times doesn't want the criminal system to be involved. Because, for example, if I was abused by a family member or relative, I don't necessarily want to put him in jail. So there are circumstances in which for the victims it is better. They want something to be done. The criminal justice system does not provide them the best or solutions because of certain limitations. So it can be good for the victims to have a voice in the process.
Right. So what you're describing is a situation where the legal process, which sometimes have a tendency to be binary, either you violated the law, you go to prison.
Exactly.
And so it allows some sort of flexibility,
yes,
which is good for the victim because they need to have their voice.
They need to have their voice, and sometimes some situations can be, so in the case of a sexual abuse by a relative or a family members, it can be very complicated because you want to punish the person, but not necessarily his family. And his family are also your relatives. So it's very, very sensitive and delicate. So we need to have alternative procedures, at least for those people who want it. And also for the perpetrator, there is work in the Netherlands showing that restorative justice procedures reduce the risk of reoffending. So, again, not always, but in some cases, I think it's good to give people the chance to, yes, to meet with their victims. And also, I think it also it also encourages responsibility taking, because, for example, perpetrators that are burglars, for example, it is very easy for them to say there is no victim here, there is insurance, nothing happens. And then only when they meet with the people and the victim tells them something like, since the burglary, I couldn't sleep because I'm always nervous, or I feel that I didn't... I failed in securing my family, giving my family security because, I don't know, because of the burglary, or you stole pictures of nostalgic values that I can never restore. So these things, it's very meaningful to hear, because for the transgressors or the offenders, it's sometimes very easy to dismiss the harm that they do. So the
of course. Now, is there any input by people, professionals, psychologists and psychiatrists in the process as to the possibility of a personality disorder? Because sometimes the offenders, the perpetrators, suffer from a certain, you know, personality disorder. They can be psychopaths, they can be, you know, whatever.
Yeah, so they don't suffer. We suffer.
Yeah.
The environment suffers.
And at least in popular culture, you're being told that they have no problem whatsoever lying.
Yeah.
They don't have any empathy to the other. And so they could play a role. Is there any mechanism in place to try and detect that possibility?
I don't know about like a scientific way to do that. It's mainly intuition. So, for example, in the restorative justice procedure, there will be a social worker or a policeman or policewoman that meet with the people and try to sense them and to get their reactions and whether they are sincere and authentic or not. But that's why it was so important for me to stress.
Yeah, that there are that, cases.
Yes, and of course, this can be exploited.
And they can also, you know, there's some people that they don't have to be psychopaths, but they are able, and it's almost a human mechanism. They're able to convince themselves it's not their fault; it's the victim's fault.
Yes, it's very common. It is rare that victims and perpetrators perceive the severity of the harm as equal. It is usually the case that that perpetrators, even if they acknowledge, many times they don't acknowledge that they did anything wrong, but even if they do, they often say, yes, okay, I did something wrong, but it is time to move on. But the victim is overreacting. And to be honest, as social psychologists, we cannot judge who is right and who is wrong. And that's a limitation of our profession or our discipline, that I cannot tell whether the victim is overreacting or whether the perpetrator is underestimating the severity of the harm. All I can do is to show that there is this gap, that this is something that is very robust. We always find this gap between victims and perpetrators.
Now, what other countries are doing this based on your experience? Where do you see more and more of that kind of restorative justice happening, taking place?
So I know that it started in, or to the best of my knowledge, it started in New Zealand, where they, I think they actually adopted the indigenous traditions of the Maui, and then they tried to incorporate these practices within their legal system. I know that they tried to do it in the UK and in the Netherlands, because I read some papers about it. And I know that from my personal experience that it happens here in Israel, but to the best of my knowledge, it is still in the margin. It's not in the mainstream
yet. Well, it seems to me, yeah, that so we can learn a lot from ancient cultures, especially indigenous cultures. And I wonder if you had any chance to look at the issue of blood feuds between clans in our region, in the Middle East, especially nomadic tribes had this, you know, still they do in some parts of the Middle East, blood feuds that between families and clans that last hundreds of years. If this methodology could try and help us fix that problem.
No.
you think it's too big?
Yes, it's beyond my expertise, because I only study Western
culture.
Participants.
Okay.
Or...
Now, the other part, so reconciliation is a big part of your scientific work. The other part relates to what we call gender equality. And so I would love to hear more about that part of your work.
Yeah, so...
How do you improve the relations between... the genders?
Yes, I would say I would begin with something that is also related to the reconciliation. So what I say about reconciliation is that if we want to promote reconciliation, then we need to give the victims respect, right? To restore their agentic identity, as I said before, the sense of agency. And we need to give perpetrators the feeling that they are not socially excluded, that they are perceived as moral despite what they did. Because if they feel morally threatened, that people perceive them as immoral, then it creates a threat that deters them from trying to reconcile. So this is a little bit counterintuitive, because I think many times people think that if we stress the blame or the guilt of the perpetrator, then they are more likely to apologize or to seek a reconciliation. But what we see is that in many cases, it's the other way around. So this is what I learned from my work on reconciliation in general. And if I think about it in the context of gender relations, I think that it's important on the one hand to respect women and to have them to give them agency and voice, but on the other hand to do it in a way that does not blame all men for being perpetrators or for being sexist and so forth. So there is always this effort to provide both parties a positive social identity,
and so that balance seems to me that kind of got lost with the rise of social media. So when you do your work in the lab, do you devote any particular attention to what's happening in the realm of social media?
Not yet, because what we do in social psychology is that we try to do. I hope they are clear, but to isolate variables and to look at things in the lab in a way that is a little bit artificial. And now in Tel Aviv, they opened the Center for Data Science and Artificial Intelligence. So I hope to collaborate with them in order to do work in the social media, but I haven't done so yet, except for one little study. But I think that you are right in your observation that the social media promotes what we call a culture of victimization, that people seek to stress their victimization and not necessarily look for a dialogue with the other party in a way that promotes that does not promote constructive dialogue and resolution and finding a way for collaboration and improvement. And that's something that is very bad, and I still haven't studied it, but it will be very interesting for me to study.
Have you experienced any backlash from certain quarters in the academic world? Because as we saw after 10/7, there was this prevailing assumption that the victim is always right. And this binary worldview, yes, of oppressors versus oppressed, and the oppressed are always, they're pure almost. They're pure. There's nothing that they do that is wrong. And people are unable to even imagine the underdog as brutal, violent, deadly, and so on. Have you encountered any backlash from those people that buy into this existentialist argument that I think was first made by Salt, who said that the only criteria for truth must come from those who are suffering? They're the ones who will decide what is true and what is not true.
Yeah, so I can answer in two levels. One, in the level of my work. One of the criticism on my work is that I give the same room for the needs or the identity needs of the perpetrator and the victim, because I said the victims need to be respected, they need their voice, they need their agentic identity, positive agentic identity. So this is something that is easy for people to accept. But I also say that the perpetrators have needs. So if you just condemn them, it's counterproductive. It's likely to lead to a backlash. So some people don't like this, that in my theory, in my model or theoretical model that I'm trying to promote, it gives room or in a way puts in equal footing both the needs of the victims and the needs of the perpetrators. So this is at the theoretical level. At the practical level, I also serve besides my academic, not besides, but unrelated to my research, I also serve as the president of the European Association for Social Psychology. And there are some voices in our community that called to condemn. I don't even want to repeat, like the BDS, and call for boycott Israel. And I think that they reflect a very simplistic view in which the weaker party is always right and the stronger party is always wrong, or whatever the weaker party does is right. And I think that it reflects intellectual laziness.
How do you explain that? I'm very, you're an academic, I'm not an academic, and I'm always baffled by the fact that you have serious people, highly educated people, and I can understand their frustration with Israel. Many Israelis are frustrated with Israel. I can understand.
True. I'm also frustrated.
But what I don't understand is how come they're so sensitive about everything that Israel does, and they don't care about North Korea, Iran, Syria, even the failings of
Sudan,
the
Yemen,
United States, and England, and Canada, and Iraq, and Afghanistan, of course, Yemen, and you mentioned Saudi Arabia, Sudan. So how do they explain that to themselves, this hypersensitivity when it comes to Israel, that lack of sensitivity when it comes to the rest of the world? I'm just curious. I mean, these are psychologists, social psychologists.
Yes, I will... I never ask them, because I don't. The reason why I don't ask is that I think that they will answer that what I'm doing is whataboutism.
Whataboutism, in my view, is the most valid question that we need to ask today, is the question of what about? Yeah, because that's the definition of anti-Semitism and racism and bigotry, the singling out of one group in a discriminatory fashion. So when you say everybody's allowed into this country club other than the blacks, that's racism. Everybody's allowed into this hotel other than Jews, that's anti-Semitism. So when you say every country is allowed to be normal other than Israel, that's anti-Semitism. And I'm curious as to why they don't see that.
I think that it is a combination of many things. So first of all, I think that maybe... they think that again, I'm speaking, I never engaged in this conversation with a particular person because...
Yeah, of course, sensitive.
Yes, but I would guess that, first of all, they would say Israel wants to belong to the West, so we have more leverage on Israel. They can also suggest to boycott China, for example, because of Tibet, or, but then I think China won't care. So one thing that they can answer is that they have more influence on us than on other non-Western countries. Another thing that they can answer is, again, I'm not accepting this argument, but I'm just putting myself in their shoes and trying to imagine. So they would say that that we want to. So for example, I think that if they do an academic boycott on I don't know Yemen, it won't really have an influence because Yemeni scholars don't publish in our journals. I mean, of the West. So it will affect Israelis, but not other countries. So this could be one reason.
Well, we'll give them the benefit of the that they do that because they care.
Because they about care whom? About
Israel, about Israel's adversaries. They care, right? So that's how, at least, that's what they say to themselves. That's what makes them feel good. Caring for the needy, for the suffering, always makes people feel good. But that's a fascinating subject. And so I wanted to, first of all, you know, we're running out of time. I wanted to...
I thought we haven't started yet.
What I wanted to do is to conclude our discussion with some words from you about what are your plans for the future in terms of the lab and your work. So you are focusing on reconciliation, gender equality. In many ways, you're combining the two. And so what's the next step?
I think that the next step that I already mentioned was to collaborate with the Center for Data Science and Artificial Intelligence, because as I said before, most of my work is done in what we call a lab, or the lab in social psychology can also mean an online experiment. It's not necessarily that we bring participants to a specific room that is called the lab, but still, I think it will be very interesting to study. To do internet studies, to study groups,
to be able to analyze.
Yes, like incels is very interesting for me. In that, you know what incels are.
The concept of incel, yeah.
Yeah, so it will be very interesting to study their forums for me as a gender researcher. So doing this big data studies is very fascinating to me.
Yeah, do you want to tell our viewers a little bit about what is incel? I believe it refers to a very specific type of men.
Yes, I would say in general, I think that it is interesting to learn about hate groups. So incels is a hate group against women. I think that it is officially
recognized as a hate group.
Basically, they argue that it's unfair that some men has access to sex and others don't. I don't know much about them, but they do.
I think they refrain from sex, right?
That they are upset about not getting sex.
Oh, okay.
but they already did.
So they don't do it willingly. So they're frustrated. What's not happening?
Yes, but they're frustrated. But they also, I think that they have like argument that it's unfair. It's like they're. It's not just that they're frustrated at the individual level. They make it a group level, that it's unfair that women control a resource that is not equally distributed or something like that.
So it seems like they're turning the table on the argument often raised by women about the patriarchy, right? So they say the same thing now. They're turning the table on this.
Yes, but they also had a couple of terror attacks on women. Maybe you remember that in a couple of years ago in Canada, an incel drove over people waiting in the, I think it was a bus station or something. But so this will be interesting, but I also want to say something positive, that it is also interesting to study reconciliation initiatives in the internet. So, for example, after Shomer Chomot, there was an initiative to bring together Israeli Arabs and Israeli Jews. So it is interesting to see what type of posts, for example, get more shares and likes by others, and try to see, first of all, whether the work that I did also replicates in what we call it in the field, so in the social networks in this case, whether the restoration of minorities, agentic identities, and majorities, moral identity, is indeed fruitful in or encourages a more constructive intergroup dialogue. So this would be also an interesting thing to explore. But basically, I would say getting out of the lab and to the real world.
Yeah, and I would just throw, I mean, when you're speaking, an idea comes to mind that the same way social media platforms in a way replicate pre-internet world. So, for example, former what used to be Twitter and other social media platforms is where the debate is being held, right? Sometimes it's a vicious debate. Sometimes it's an
very
angry
vicious
debate.
I think that there is something about this platform that makes it very vicious.
Absolutely. The algorithm is encouraging it. So my idea, and maybe you'd like to look into it, is maybe there should be a place where people come to to make peace online.
Yes, or develop an algorithm that does the opposite of what the current algorithm
exactly
does. Yes, this would be my dream.
That will probably not be very profitable, this algorithm, but who knows? But who knows? Well, it's been a pleasure to host you in our studio. And I'd like to thank you so much for being
here.
Thank
you.
And please keep us posted and keep our university friends posted as to your really important work.
Thank you. So thank you for hosting me.
Our pleasure. And to our viewers and listeners at home, goodbye from Tel Aviv until our next episode. Bye-bye.